So, folks, this is part three in our series on the satanic policy of evil and how it is implemented by Satan in the world today. Last week in part two, we were ready to begin developing the third characteristic of the world system as it pertains to the satanic policy of evil, and that was point number three, which says the world system is the channel through which Satan's program is developed. And we want to see exactly how he does this. And to do this, we're going to take a look at an interesting event which took place in Israel's history during the reign of King Ahab of the northern kingdom of Israel and King Jehoshaphat of the southern kingdom of Judah. Those two kings were contemporary with one another. Now, this event is recorded in both 1 Kings chapter 22 and also in 2 Chronicles chapter 18. And we're going to follow the record in 1 Kings. But before we get into the key verses there, it will be helpful to gain a little understanding of the historical context of what was going on at the time. So if you will, turn to the book of 1 Kings, and just to review a bit, you might remember that King Ahab was generally considered to be the worst king Israel had ever had, at least up to that point in time. King Ahab was the king who officially established Baal worship as the official religion in the northern kingdom of Israel. Ahab was the king who reigned in the northern kingdom of Israel during that famous confrontation between the prophet Elijah and the prophets of Baal in 1 Kings chapter 18. Interestingly, King Jehoshaphat of Judah, on the other hand, was just the opposite. He was one of the southern kingdom's greatest kings. He was a godly man. In 2 Chronicles chapter 17, it describes how that the Lord was with Jehoshaphat in all the things that he did because Jehoshaphat walked in the ways of his father David. And that's one of the highest compliments any of the kings could ever receive. And Jehoshaphat did all sorts of great things throughout the southern kingdom of Judah. So let's begin here in 1 Kings chapter 22 and verse 1. And they continued 3 years without war between Syria and Israel. And it came to pass in the third year that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. Now, the account starts off here with something that is totally unexpected because it seems so unlikely that someone like King Jehoshaphat would involve himself in any way with King Ahab. But he does. Elsewhere in the scripture, it seems to indicate that King Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram, actually married Athaliah, who was the daughter of King Ahab and Jezebel. Now, that was obviously a bad choice, but it happened. And perhaps that's the basis on which this unusual alliance evolved. But continuing on in verse 3, and the king of Israel said unto his servants, know ye that Ramoth-Gilead is ours, and we be still, and take it not out of the hand of the king of Syria. And he said unto Jehoshaphat, wilt thou go with me to battle to Ramoth-Gilead? And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, I am as thou art, my people as thy people, my horses as thy horses. Now Ramoth-Gilead was a city in the region where the tribe of Gad was located in the northern kingdom. It was currently occupied by Syria as a consequence of the Lord's second course of punishment against Israel. And now King Ahab decides he wants to get it back, so he wants to know if King Jehoshaphat would join forces with him in battle to get it back. So apparently, based on the relationship between King Jehoshaphat's son and King Ahab's daughter, King Jehoshaphat agrees, and he agrees to join forces with Ahab, and immediately King Jehoshaphat suggests that they do what should be done, and that is to see what the Lord has to say about this proposition. verse 5. And Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord. Good thought. So what does King Ahab do? Verse 6. Then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said unto them, shall I go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And they said, go up, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. So Ahab gathers together his prophets to inquire of the Lord whether the Lord is going to enable him to take the city from the Assyrians or not. Now, I find it interesting that the verse says there are about 400 of these prophets. Back during that famous confrontation between Elijah and the prophets of Baal in chapter 18, there were 450 prophets of Baal. These are probably a lot of the same guys. And of course, these are all false prophets. These are all a bunch of phonies, and King Jehoshaphat knows that. So he says in verse 7, and Jehoshaphat said, is there not here a prophet of the Lord besides that we might inquire of him? So King Jehoshaphat says, how about we consult a legitimate prophet, someone who actually can inquire of the Lord? You see, King Ahab shouldn't need 400 opinions here. All you need is one legitimate prophet of the Lord. So King Ahab responds in verse 8, he says, and the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, there is yet one man, Micaiah, the son of Imlah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord. But I hate him, for he doth not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. So King Ahab, turns out, does have one legitimate prophet of the Lord. His name is Micaiah, and he is usually in prison because Ahab hates the guy. Why? Because Micaiah never tells the king what he wants to hear. Micaiah always gives him the truth. This is exactly as Paul writes in Galatians 4:16, which says, am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? That's the situation you have here between King Ahab and Micaiah. Continuing on in verse 9. Then the king of Israel called an officer and said, hasten hither Micaiah, the son of Imlah. And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, sat each on his throne, having put on their robes in a void place in the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied before them. And Zedekiah, the son of Shenaanah, made him horns of iron, and he said, thus saith the Lord, with these shalt thou push the Syrians until thou hast consumed them. And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the king's hand. So now all these false prophets are even putting on theatrics. Guy makes horns, says, this is the way you're going to go and get them. And they're telling the king Ahab exactly what he wants to hear. Go up to Ramoth-Gilead. You can't lose. The Lord is with you all the way. Now, this kind of response is exactly as Isaiah describes the stupidity with which Israel has dealt with legitimate prophets of the Lord all along. And that's in Isaiah chapter 30, verses 9 and 10. It's such a classical passage that if you're not familiar with it, you need to hear it. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 9 says, this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Lord, which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. A perfect description of Ahab's attitude. And then Micaiah enters the picture. Now the messenger that went to get Micaiah out of prison has already coached Micaiah on what he should say in front of King Ahab. All of Ahab's false prophets have already told the king exactly what Ahab wanted to hear, so he advises Micaiah to do the same thing. Verse 13. And the messenger that was gone to call Micaiah spake unto him, saying, behold now, the words of the prophets declare good unto the king what he wants to hear. With one mouth, let thy word, I pray thee, be like the word of one of them, and speak that which is good. Tell the king what he wants to hear. And Micaiah's response in verse 14 is, and Micaiah said, as the Lord liveth, what the Lord saith unto me, that will I speak. Well, you wouldn't expect any other response from a true prophet of the Lord. So now Micaiah is in front of the two kings, Ahab and Jehoshaphat, and says in verse 15, So he came to the king, and the king said unto Micaiah, shall we go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? And he answered him, go and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. Now, you got to follow closely what's really going on here. And this response from Micaiah is actually the height of sarcasm. And King Ahab recognizes that immediately. It's like as though Micaiah is saying to the king, you have 400 prophets here. They all told you you can go up. You're going to be victorious. Just go. What do you need me for? So Ahab responds, because he knows this is sarcasm. In verse 16, Ahab says, and the king said unto him, how many times shall I adjure thee that thou tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord? Now I'm going to paraphrase this verse, because it's a little difficult to pick up what's going on here. But this response from Ahab is basically saying, Micaiah, you have never once told me what I want to hear. So I know darn well that you're not telling me the truth about this either. And of course he wasn't. So then Micaiah gets serious and he gives Ahab the truth. Verse 17, and he said to Ahab, I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills as sheep that have not a shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let them return, every man to his house in peace. Which is to say that if Ahab takes Israel to battle against Syria, he's going to be killed. And his entire army is going to be running around all over the place with no leader. So don't even go. Stay in your homes. Don't go. Then Ahab says to King Jehoshaphat, verse 18, and the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell thee that he would prophesy no good concerning me but evil? But Micaiah was not yet finished with his word from the Lord. And this is what we really came here to see. Micaiah is going to give Ahab and us a little insight into the workings of the spiritual realm. And what does Micaiah go on to say? Verse 19, and he said, hear thou therefore the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the hosts of heaven standing by him, on his right hand and on his left. Now, does this scene remind you of anything we've already looked at? How about those passages in Job chapter 1 and Job chapter 2 that we looked at in part 1? Let me review those for you. Job chapter 1, verse 6 said, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And then in Job chapter 2, verse 1, we read almost the same thing. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. Now, we referred to these two passages earlier in this study when we wanted to demonstrate that the sons of God in Genesis chapter 6, verse 2, was a reference to members of the angelic community, that the sons of God in those passages are angels. But as interesting as that may be, there is a matter of much greater significance for our understanding to be gleaned from these two passages in Job and from what Micaiah has just said in verse 19. From these three passages, and other passages as well, which we'll see, we learn that there is a meeting place somewhere in the universe where God and the angelic community congregate from time to time in order to hash out whatever God feels needs to be addressed. And as we can see from the two passages in Job, it is not just God's elect good angels who are present at these meetings. Satan was there as well, undoubtedly with a contingent of his own fallen angels, those principalities and powers which we began looking at in Ephesians 6 at the beginning of this study. And the prophet Micaiah is about to give King Ahab and us another glimpse into another one of those meetings. Verse 19 again. And he said, "Hear thou therefore the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by him, on his right hand and on his left." So all the host of heaven is there again, just like we saw in Job chapters 1 and 2. Now, this is entirely speculative on my part, but my guess would be that God's good elect angels were over on his right hand, and any of those associated with Satan's camp were probably on the left. Verse 20, as we continue on here, "And the Lord said, who shall persuade Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said on this matter, and another said on that matter." You see, the issue here, the issue at hand, was the death of King Ahab, somehow coercing King Ahab to go up to battle in Ramoth-Gilead so that Ahab would be killed. Killed, in fact, in the very manner in which the prophet Isaiah had prophesied in 1 Kings chapter 21, verses 17 through 29, exactly how King Ahab would be killed. 3 years earlier, in 1 Kings 21, verses 17 through 29, you can read a very interesting and detailed account from the prophet Isaiah informing King Ahab that because of all of the evil things that he had done, that his death was just around the corner, and now the time has come. So this fascinating meeting with the Lord and all these angels is held for the express purpose of orchestrating Ahab into this battle at Ramoth-Gilead so that he will be killed, just as Isaiah described his death. Notice in verse 20, it also says that one said on this manner and another said on that manner. So you have these members of the host of heaven, the angelic community, offering their suggestions on how to orchestrate Ahab's death. Let's read that verse again. "And the Lord said, who shall persuade Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said on this manner and another said on that manner. And there came forth a spirit and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him." So this spirit comes forth and says to the Lord, I will persuade him. Now think about this for a minute. One of these angels says that he will persuade Ahab to go up for the battle, and then the Lord responds to that suggestion in verse 22, "And the Lord said unto him, wherewith?" In other words, how are you going to do this? How are you going to do it? "And he said, I will go forth and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said," this is the Lord now says, "thou shalt persuade him and prevail also. Go forth and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord hath put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these thy prophets, and the Lord hath spoken evil concerning thee." Now, that is exactly what we saw coming out of the mouths of those 400 prophets. So Isaiah is describing what has already happened here. The 400 prophets of the king giving him false information. And what is so stunningly revealing about what is going on here is the fact that an angel, whether that angel is a principality angel with a high rank like Michael the Archangel, or a power angel like Gabriel was, what is so stunningly revealing about what's going on here is the fact that these angels, these ministering spirits, as Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14 describes them, that these ministering spirits can affect the thoughts and the resultant actions of men on the earth. Now, think about that. That's pretty scary. They can affect the thoughts and the actions of men on the earth. And then as you read through the rest of chapter 22, the details of the death of King Ahab takes place just as Isaiah had prophesied in 1 Kings 21, verses 17 through 29. My guess would be that the spirit which went forth from the Lord in this account was probably one of the Lord's elect good angels, but the point is that there is every reason to be able to extrapolate this kind of spiritual activity and influence to Satan's fallen angels as well. It could be that even the demons, those who are the disembodied spirit byproducts of those original angels that left their first estate in Genesis 6, it could be that these demons may be able to do this as well. I don't know for sure that they can, but for sure either the principality or power angels, or maybe both, probably both, are certainly able to do this. That is, if you want to believe the verses in the account. Now let's look at this type of spiritual influence in another place, and that's Revelation chapter 16. You'll turn over there for a moment. Revelation 16. And the context here is the impending battle of Armageddon. We're going to begin in verse 12. Revelation 16, verse 12. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water there was dried up. Why was this being done? That the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophets. So here we have three unclean spirits coming out of the mouths of that unholy counterfeit trinity comprised of Satan, the false prophet, and the Antichrist. And then we get a little more information about these unclean spirits in the next verse, verse 14. For they are the spirits of devils, demons, working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. The verse says, they are the spirits of devils, demons. It says that these unclean spirits are the spirits of devils or demons. So this does suggest that these disembodied spirit byproducts of those original angels that left their first estate in Genesis 6, that they may indeed be capable of influencing the thoughts and resultant actions of men and kings on the earth. And notice that it says that they can also even do miracles. And the verse says that these spirits are going forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world. Why? To influence them, in this case, to come to the final battle of Armageddon. They are influencing and affecting the thoughts and actions of kings, of rulers, of men. If you continue on down through the rest of the chapter, you see in verse 16 how that this is indeed the final battle of Armageddon. And then the verses which follow give us a few more details of the results of the battle, which you can study out on your own, as that's not pertinent to our objectives here. Now, I'd like to take you to one more passage in the scriptures, which give us yet another look at one of these fascinating meetings that the Lord has with the principalities and powers within the angelic heavenly community. And that's Psalm 82, actually Psalm 82 in its entirety. So if you'll go with me there to Psalm 82. Psalm 82, I don't mind telling you that most of my Christian life, I never had a clue what Psalm 82 was all about. But when you start to put together all the pieces of the things we've seen throughout this study, it all begins to make perfect sense. So Psalm 82, verse 1, says, God standeth in the congregation of the mighty. He judgeth among the gods. So here is another one of those congregational meetings, just like we saw in Job chapters 1 and 2, and 1 Kings 22. And the purpose of this meeting is to judge among the gods, the small g gods. And these gods are also referred to here as the mighty. They may be small g gods, but they're mighty nonetheless. Now, who are these gods? Well, we've been looking at them all throughout this study. They're members of the angelic community. The first place we looked at these small g gods was in the Ephesians 6 passage, where they were referred to as principalities and powers. In other of the passages describing these principalities and powers, we're informed of their mights and their dominions. They were also referred to as the rulers of the darkness of this world. These small g gods are rulers. We also saw that these small g gods, way back in Deuteronomy 32, where Moses foresaw that the demise of Israel was going to be the worshiping of and the sacrificing to these small g gods that their fathers knew not, these strange small g gods that had newly come up, not down, come up, and which were also referred to as devils or demons. We also saw how that these small g gods are part of the armor of the primary god of this world, who is Satan. They are part of his armor. He has armor. Satan is the head of it all. And the Lord has something he wants to say to these small g gods in Satan's camp. Verse 2, he says, how long will ye judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? These small g gods are failing to rule justly. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. They are accepting and allowing wickedness to prevail within their particular dominions on the earth. How are they doing this? They're doing this by influencing the thoughts and actions of their human counterparts, the human kings and rulers within their particular dominions, just as we saw in the Revelation 16 passage. Now, if you remember, in part one of this study, these angels, these small g gods, were synonymous with the princes of this world, like the prince of the kingdom of Persia and the prince of Grecia, which Gabriel had to contend with in Daniel chapter 10, verses 10 and 13. Let's continue on here in verse 3. Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Rid them out of the hand of the wicked. So these are the virtues which these small g gods were supposed to be instilling into the thoughts and actions of the human kings and rulers within their dominions. But they're not doing that. Instead, what are they doing? Verse 5, they know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. Now, I'm not sure whether this condemnation here in this verse is being leveled against the small g gods or the earthly kings and rulers who are influencing them with in their particular dominions. It could be referring to both, but whatever the case may be, look at the state of affairs at the end of the verse. It says, did we read verse 5? Yeah. It says, all the foundations of the earth are out of course. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. Have you ever heard a better description of where this world is going? Absolutely nothing is functioning according to the Lord's design. Everything is functioning according to Satan's course for this world. Look at verse 6. I have said, ye are gods, and all you are children of the Most High. In this verse, I think the Lord is speaking to both the small g gods and to the earthly kings and rulers who are being influenced by these small g gods within their particular dominions. And the Lord informs them of their ultimate fate in verse 7. But ye shall die like men and fall like one of the prophets. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for thou shalt inherit all nations. Okay. By this verse, you should make a note of Isaiah chapter 24, verse 21. In fact, that verse is so pertinent to these verses, we should take a look at it. If you want to go to Isaiah 24, verse 21, it reads, and it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, those of the angelic community, and the kings of the earth upon the earth, those men and rulers who those angelic entities are influencing. Do you see how the hosts of the high ones on high, the angelic community, are intimately connected to the human kings and rulers of the earth? How that the high ones on high are influencing the thoughts and actions of human rulers on the earth? Some of this stuff gets pretty frightening when you think about it. But I want to summarize now some of the things we've seen pertaining to the influence of the satanic policy of evil on mankind. Now, we've just seen the satanic policy of evil influencing the thoughts and actions of men in Israel's program by influencing the thoughts and actions of the earthly kings and rulers within their particular dominions of those, the dominions of those principalities and powers. We've seen how that the worshiping and sacrificing to the small g gods, as Moses described it in Deuteronomy 32, verse 17, how that was actually the demise of Israel before the first coming of Christ. None of that should have occurred or would have occurred if Israel and the earthly kings and rulers would have been living according to the word of God rather than being influenced by these principalities and powers. And you might want to make a note to check out Deuteronomy 13 sometime. We won't go there now, but there's a lot of information there in Deuteronomy 13 that the Lord had given Israel to be aware of, not to be influenced by these spiritual entities. Now, we've also seen how that the satanic policy of evil was at work by means of physical demonic possession of people throughout the land of Palestine at Christ's first coming in an attempt to render the land unsuitable for the prophesied kingdom. And we also saw how that during this present dispensation of grace, various degrees of spiritual demonic possession, or if you want to refer to it rather as influence, how that can take place even in a believer. We saw that spiritual demonic possession or influence is possible in a believer because the old man, with his old sin nature, still resides in every believer. And we saw that the one clear common denominator of all these various degrees of demonic spiritual possession or influence in a believer today is failing to know, or failing to heed, or failing to remember the information that our Apostle Paul has given us to know and to understand and to remember. And the degree to which a believer fails to know, heed, or remember the information given to us by Paul is the degree to which that believer leaves himself open to the spiritual demonic possession or influence of the satanic policy of evil. Now, if this type of spiritual demonic possession is possible even in a believer, imagine what it is capable of doing in someone who has absolutely no use for God or the Bible. How many of you have ever heard of a man named Yuval Noah Harari? Has anybody heard of this guy? Yuval Noah Harari? This man is a professor in the Department of History at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. This man is also one of the leading voices and the top advisor to the World Economic Forum. You know the World Economic Forum? Klaus Schwab, George Soros, Bill Gates, and that whole gang. That whole gang who meets in Davos, Switzerland on a regular basis to set their course for world society, the basis of which is a one-world government, just as Satan would have it. These, by the way, men like this are the great men of the earth, which the Bible describes in Revelation, primarily Revelation 18. And that's a very interesting study if you want to study these great men of the earth. And I think what they've will have accomplished will become quite clear to you if you study that out. It's not that hard to figure out. And it seems that these folks and the spokesman here for the World Economic Forum, these folks are no longer hesitant to lay all their cards on the table, so to speak. And I'd like you to hear a series of quotes from this man, Yuval Noah Harari, from various interviews he has given over the last 2 years in association with the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, when I give you these quotes, I'm going to quote it exactly the way he said it. He has a heavy accent, and his English is a little bit broken, so the sentence structure is not always going to be what it should be. But you'll get the picture. I'm going to quote him exactly as he said it. Quote, COVID is critical because this is what convinces people to accept, to legitimize total biometric surveillance. If we want to stop this epidemic, we need not just to monitor people, we need to monitor what's happening under their skin. What we have seen so far is corporations and governments collecting data about where we go, who we meet, what movies we watch. The next phase of surveillance is going under our skin. We now see mass surveillance systems, even in democratic countries which previously rejected them, and we also see a change in the nature of surveillance. Previously, surveillance was mainly above the skin. Now it's going under the skin. Governments want to know not just where we go or who we meet. Above all, they want to know what is happening under our skin. What is our body temperature? What is our blood pressure? What is our medical condition? Now, humans are developing even bigger power than before. We are really acquiring divine power of creation and destruction. We are really upgrading humans into God by acquiring the power to re-engineer life. I know that in recent years we saw popular politicians deliberately undermining the trust that people have in important institutions like universities, like respectable media outlets. These popular politicians told people that the scientists are the small elite, disconnected from the real people. I mean, all these stories about Jesus rising from the dead and being the Son of God, this is fake news. Now, I'm going to interrupt the quotes here because if you folks don't recognize this is the epitome of Romans chapter 1, 21 through 23, that is what you have here. It doesn't get any better than this. Continue on with the quotes now. Humans are now hackable animals. You know, the whole idea that humans have, you know, they have this soul, the spirit, and they have free will, and nobody knows what's happening inside me, so whatever I choose, whether in an election or whether in the supermarket, this is my free will, that's over. That's over. This is all what is commonly called the Great Reset, or to build back better. In the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century, what humanity basically learned to produce was all kinds of stuff, like textiles and shoes and weapons and vehicles. And this was enough for very few countries that underwent the revolution fast enough to subjugate everybody else. What we're talking about now is like a second Industrial Revolution. But the product this time will not be textiles or machines or vehicles or even weapons. The product this time will be humans themselves. I'm going to interrupt the quotes here again because I want to bring your attention to Pastor Peter's message just a few days ago on July 7th of year 2022, where he mentioned in his message the importance of what Satan is doing in capturing and controlling the mind, controlling our minds, that this is being done by Satan. He mentioned that several times. Now I'm going to continue with the quotes. We're basically learning to produce bodies and minds. Bodies and minds are those, I think, are going to be the two main products of the next wave of all these changes. And if we lead again between those who know how to produce bodies and minds and those that do not, then this is far greater than anything we saw before in history. And this time, if you are not following the revolution fast enough, then you probably become extinct. Once you know how to produce bodies and brains and minds, so cheap labor in Africa or Asia or wherever, it simply counts for nothing. And here, I think, is the biggest question, maybe in economics and politics of the coming decades, will be what to do with these useless people. I don't think we have an economic model for that. My best guess, and it's just a guess, is that food will not be a problem. With that kind of technology, you will be able to produce food to feed everybody. The problem is more boredom. What to do with them and how to find some sense of meaning in life when they are basically meaningless, worthless. My best guess at present is a combination of drugs and computer games. End of quotes. Yuval Noah Harari, the main spokesperson for the World Economic Forum and their forecast for the future of human society. Now, this man has his own website, and on the front page of that website, you will find another of his quotes, which goes, "History began when humans invented gods and will end when humans become God." So then what do you think the satanic policy of evil can do? Well, I should say has already done to influence the thoughts and actions of men like this. Well, these quotes from Yuval Noah Harari, which I just presented to you, are the answer to that question. Remember what the Lord said in Psalm 82, verse 5? They know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. Have you ever heard a better description of where this world is going? Nothing is functioning according to the Lord's design. Everything is functioning according to Satan's course for this world, which we read about in Ephesians chapter 2. Now, I tried to demonstrate to you some of the differences and the reasons for the differences between the manner in which the satanic policy of evil was working in Israel's program at Christ's first coming and the manner in which the satanic policy of evil works during this current dispensation of grace. I pointed out how that the prolific abundance of physical demonic possession in Israel at the time of Christ's first coming was part of Satan's armament, part of his armor in rendering the land of Palestine unsuitable for the kingdom. Why? Because establishing a literal physical kingdom was what God was doing at the time. But that's not what God is doing today. Nevertheless, I would submit to you that there are some very interesting analogous counterparts with the satanic policy of evil to some of the things which went on during Christ's first coming and some of the things which we do see today in this present dispensation of grace. I'm sure you remember the account in Matthew chapter 17, verses 14 through 16, of the man who came to Jesus because his son had been possessed by a demon from a very young age. Remember how this demon frequently tried to kill this man's son by throwing him into the fire or into the water, literally trying to kill him? Well, that's perfectly consistent with Satan's goal to steal and to kill and destroy, as it says in the Gospel of John, chapter 10, verse 10. His goal is to destroy and kill people. And I would suggest to you that there are certain analogous counterparts to that type of satanic activity which was going on during Christ's first coming and this present dispensation of grace. The differences are that they are just not overtly obvious, but they are there nonetheless. Now let me explain the types of things I'm talking about. If you were to Google the topic of suicides and satanic cults, you might be surprised what you're going to find. When I did this, the first thing that came up was an abstract on PubMed.gov from the National Institute of Health, from an article titled Satanism and Suicide in Adolescence, Two Case Reports. And the abstract from that article read as follows. Death cases, suicides as well as homicides within the context of Satanism are meanwhile becoming routine casework for forensic pathologists. Therefore, the investigators should be aware of satanic signs and items associated with the occult to identify a satanic background. Based on two suicides of young persons, satanic signs helpful for classification are pointed out. And then if you read through the article, you would learn about what those are, what things to look for. Now, folks, this kind of activity is not a whole lot different, in my mind, than the demonic activity which was responsible for what we read about in Matthew chapter 17, verses 14 through 16, where the demon was frequently trying to kill this man's son by throwing him into the fire, into the water, literally trying to kill him. The only difference is that this type of stuff which is going on today is just not overtly obvious to us. Then we have this whole transgender issue. On the Center for Suicide Prevention website, under the topic of transgender people and suicide fact sheet, you will find the following statistics and facts. First, over 10% of transgender people report recently attempting suicide within the previous year. Two, 22 to 43% of transgender people have attempted suicide in their lifetime. And one more, two-thirds of transgender youth report self-harm within the previous year. Folks, if you are desperately seeking an identity which you don't feel you have access to, and then when you take the measures which you or which society tell you you need to take in order to achieve that identity, and when you take those measures only to discover that the identity that you were seeking did not measure up to your expectations, how do you think you're going to react then? Because the only identity that will ever fulfill the emotional or the psychological or the spiritual needs of a human being is the identity that someone is able to realize in Christ, period. End of story. That is what's supposed to be our identity. And when you have that identity, and when you know and understand everything that is associated with that identity, not only during life here on the earth, but also on throughout all eternity, that's the only identity you would ever want anyway. And on that note, I'm going to end this series on the satanic policy of evil. I realize that this has not been a very uplifting body of information, but I do think that this is information which is very important to know and to understand, and information which I think the more mature believers who hear this message should be able to understand and appreciate, especially during this present evil world, which is only destined to get worse. I want to say that I think ever since Keith Blade's book, Satan and His Policy of Evil, came out, my opinion has been that this whole concept of the satanic policy of evil is a concept that is greatly underappreciated. Obviously, this is not as important as knowing and understanding and preaching the gospel of the grace of God, but I think that these evils of Satan are so important to know and understand that, well, that's why I did this series. So I would say know the enemy and know how he operates. Now, I'll open this up to any questions if anybody has any questions. The question is, if these transgender people are harming themselves or killing themselves, isn't that working against working against what Satan wants to do? No, I would say that that's exactly what Satan wants to do. He wants to steal and to kill and destroy. He doesn't care how he does it. Just, I want to steal what's not mine. I want to kill and destroy. That's what he's been doing. Okay, any other questions? Okay, well then on a word of prayer.